Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I am your hostess, Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Ashley McGuire.
And we are thrilled to have joining us today the amazing author, cook, and farmer extraordinaire, Emily Zanotti. She has written a terrific piece this month in the National Catholic Register about the joys and the trials of taking young children to Mass, all stemming from a viral photo of her very pious son kneeling at Mass. What led up to that photo being taken? Emily, thank you so much for coming back to chat with us today.
Of course.
Okay, so I burst out laughing reading the title of this, The Unsilence of the Lambs Inside the Beautiful Mess of Mass with Small Children. What brought about this terrific article, Emily?
So this photograph that was taken of my son at the All Souls Day Mass, we had somehow managed to get into the front row. We usually sit pretty far up, but we don't usually sit in the front row. And the kids, when there's kneelers, cannot see over the edge of the communion rail.
Oh, okay.
Of the pew, the communion rail. Yeah.
Okay.
And so they will have a tendency to go out into the aisle or over to one of the posts and stand there. And so that's what my child had done that day. After an extended fight with his brother, he decided he wanted to sit in the aisle. And the photographer for the Nashville Diocese snapped this beautiful photo of my son just looking up at the Blessed Sacrament with his hands folded. He just looked so pious. And it was like 3 seconds before I pulled him back into the thing because he made a run for the altar. And I had a feeling he was going to celebrate, so I had to pull him
back.
Kind
of like a modern day Dominic Savio or something, you know, say Dominic Savio, who they always, you know, the little boy who was so pious.
Uh-huh. And he just looked so pious and beautiful. And I thought, you know, it might be a really cute idea for a story about all the things that happen in Mass and all the things we've been through with a bunch of kids under six that led up to this little beautiful moment. And actually, he then went back a couple days later and said that he wanted to dress as a priest for What Do You Want to Be When You Grow Up Day at school. So I feel like we do have these little moments of miracles, and it's just fun to kind of think about all the difficulties attendant of keeping little kids in Mass.
It's something I very much understand. I have 5 young children. The youngest is 2. I feel like I'm in a perpetual scene from Groundhog Day where I'm like, one day I'll sit in Mass and listen to the homily. And I loved in your article where you talk about not being able to remember the last time you really listened to the homily. And thankfully we're there first and foremost for our Lord and the Eucharist. But I'm hoping you can settle a debate that my husband and I always have, which is, do you sit in the front or the back? I'm a back seat person.
Okay.
I like the easy exit. He's a front row person because he thinks that kids have a better view and that keeps the moral dialed in. What do you say?
So I have taken the cons of the front row and we have decided that they are not as good as the pros. They constantly behave better if they're in the front row. So we've gone further back. We've gone in the back. There have been days where I think the Eucharistic procession last year was one of these where we get there just a teeny bit too late and we're all scattered sort of in the back. And every single time we've done that, it's just been a nightmare. Now, I don't know if it's just a nightmare because on that week they were not feeling it in the confluence of chocolate donuts for breakfast and a fight in the car or whatever. But I think sitting up front has been much better for us. Unfortunately, it does mean that everyone sees you. Everyone sees your kids. We do tend to sit toward the edge of the pew closest to the side aisle. So if we need to make a quick getaway, I can go out the side aisle and out the door. Or I can, you know, wait till everyone's standing and we run out the back. So I still have an exit plan, but I do think that generally they're better when they're up front. But that's just my kids. I don't pretend to think anybody is in exactly the situation I am.
Well, you know, there's a third way that my mother was a great proponent of, which is you don't take your young kids to Mass. Like my mom was very pre-Vatican II, very old school. And she would be like, I think I complained to her one day when one of them did actually strip naked in the middle of Mass one time because her dress was itchy. And she said, listen, She said, Mary, adults have an obligation to hear Mass, not to hear your children cry. And if they cannot behave themselves, you too can go to different Masses. You do not live in the middle of, you know, nowhere. You have a parish that has multiple Masses a day. And she said, you know, your father and I didn't go to Mass together probably for 15, 16 years. You know, somebody took the 6 a.m. Mass and, you know, and then too, when my brother was an altar boy, you know, sometimes he would get the earliest Mass and little kid, you know. So at any rate, her whole thing was the most important thing is that you all get to Mass. Not that you go together as a family and, you know, not that it's this moment. And I know there's much more of an emphasis now on, you know, families going as a family and that being a really important kind of bonding moment as a family. But I do sort of balance it against the actual obligation that we have, which isn't, you know, required of children until they make their first communion. But then you can't just have them show up at the age of 7 and expect to know what's happening and how to behave themselves, et cetera, et cetera. Have you ever encountered that? My mother's particular, I think this it's the greatest generation, right? And they're kind of, they're all slowly leaving us. But I just had a long talk with one of my cousins about this because she said it was just so customary that you didn't, you just, everybody just went to the Mass that they could go to more or less. And we didn't have this whole sort of, this was never an issue earlier on, I guess, or seldom an issue.
So I have run into that. I actually ran into that with a priest when our children were misbehaving in a Mass. He basically said at the end, you know, they don't have to come if you don't want them to. And I kind of bristled about it because
did he volunteer to babysit while you came?
He did not volunteer to babysit. There was no indication that that would be taken care of through the church funds, you know. And we have had situations like here in Nashville, there is a traditional Latin Mass, and for a while the church was under construction, so the Mass was held in a ballroom on a second floor with a very rickety staircase, and we really couldn't bring little kids up that staircase because it would just create a bottleneck.
Right.
So there have been times where we have done that. But I also sort of think me growing up in the heyday of kind of the happy clappy 90s Catholicism, my family really didn't go to Mass together. My husband is an adult convert, so he had never had that experience. I just didn't know much about being Catholic. I was in college at a Catholic university on the campus of a mother house, and I didn't know anything about being Catholic.
Yeah.
And so when we set out, we were like, if I want my children to think of a vocation as a real job opportunity, like they think of doctors and firemen, they got to see it in action. And I gotta show them how to do it. And it sucks because some weeks they are disruptive. Some weeks we have had knockdown, drag out, peace offs in the pew during the consecration. My daughter enjoys provoking her brothers. So if she's not getting enough attention, she's going to create that attention. And Jesus doesn't need that attention. She needs that attention. So we just figured that the way to do it is just to be with us going to Mass. The adults do it. The kids do it. Some Sundays you don't feel like it. You still go anyway. So we're all together.
What's your advice to moms and dads who've personally experienced judgmentalism? And, you know, I'm somebody who, I go to Mass every Sunday, and I've had an older woman say hurtful things to me about even being in the back with my kids. I have a friend who basically kind of trailed off going to Mass because somebody came up to her in the parking lot and said hurtful things to her. I think this is a real thing, and people do experience the judgmentalism, and it's hard. And so what would your advice or thoughts be for people who have experienced that, whether with eyeballs or words?
So we get eyeballs all the time. I am the kind of person who brushes it off. I have said something back to somebody. I had a woman shush my oldest son, my middle son, because he is neurodivergent. And so he was asking complex theological questions through the whole thing. So he and my husband are having this long form discussion. And so she said something to them. And then after Mass, I was like, you don't know what you're dealing with. You don't know what you're talking about. This is the only communication we get with him sometimes. So I said that to her, but I church shopped a little bit. Not everyone has this luxury to find a community that welcomes kids, but we tried 2 or 3 different parishes here in Nashville before we settled on the cathedral. And one of the reasons that we settled on the cathedral was the first week that my kids were there at Mass, the deacon's wife came up to them and told them how well they'd behaved and told us to keep coming. And so finding somebody who's going to tell you to keep coming when those voices are always telling you to stay home is It means the world.
Mm.
And she's been a huge player in my kids' life since then. She's basically their grandma because they don't have any grandparents who live here. So we found a community where there were other kids, where there were other kids their age, where other those kids went to mass too and misbehaved in mass too. And the bottom line is, if you don't have kids in mass, your religion isn't going anywhere. I know it's kind of trite, like if it's not crying, it's dying, but there are a lot of churches even here that you walk in and kids aren't welcome, but every single person in that church is probably over the age of 50. And then there's a reason why the place that we go and Our Lady of the Lake here in Nashville are just exploding. And it's because everyone loves having the kids there.
Well, where do you stand on like cry rooms or in the alternative? And I think cry rooms really were kind of a thing of the 80s and maybe early 90s, and those are you generally don't see them. We don't have it at my parish anymore at all. But the removal of the child when the child has just become too distraught, really, to and if it's, for example, prohibiting other people from hearing the homily, et cetera, and I went to one parish one time where they actually had a sign, and it was a parish that had a lot of young families, but it said if you're, being uncomfortable or disruptive is just part of a child's maturation, but if your child is crying for more than 3 minutes, we respectfully ask that you just come and stand in the back until your child has calmed down. And I thought that was kind of an interesting way to handle it. How do you feel about that particular approach?
I feel like that's the way I handle it without the sign. Like, if it's just like the
Like it's
normal
known.
stuff, they're smacking each other and they just need to be separated.
Yes.
Or somebody has to go to the potty, or but if we have a screamer, we have to leave.
But you'd be surprised at the number of people. I just, anyway, at a baptism, and during the entire baptism, one of the cousins or whatever just screamed through the entire thing. And the grandma was telling me later, we tried to watch the video and it was just unintelligible. We couldn't hear a thing because this child screamed and the family did not remove them. And so I'm a big Emily Zanotti fan, but also a big Emily Post fan. And I do think when it gets past 2 or 3 minutes, it's like telling people you have to turn your cell phone off because if it's going to go off, it's going to go off during the consecration, and you don't want that. So it's such a balancing act, isn't it?
It's a balancing act, and it's like any other place. I mean, it's very similar to a restaurant or a library, or you're in a public location and your child is screaming and melting down and rolling on the floor and pounding it, which, my kids have done. Sometimes you do have to leave. And I have a 4-year-old or 5-year-old, she just turned 5 right now, who has decided that screaming arguments are the only way she communicates. And so now we are in the let me scream because mommy won't let me have a crown on during the consecration. So, I can't, everyone's praying. It's silent for a reason. We need to have a focus on Christ. And when I am the one that's distracting from the focus on Christ, we gotta go. And so we go to the women's bathroom and we have a chat and then we come back. But it's a balancing act. Like, you want to be there. You want to hear the words of the gospel, hear the priest's homily, be there for the whole thing. And when you're under 6, you're in the trenches, man.
Well, we had one experience where my girls were so bad through the whole mass, and there was a little couple, very short people from Italy. We're heavily Italian American, but also people from Italy parish. And at the end of mass, the husband turned around, and they were probably in their 80s easily, and he handed my husband a $20 bill and said, "Go get the kids some ice cream." And it was so sweet. It wasn't judgy. It wasn't, he's like, "Why don't you take your kids and give them some ice cream?" And they still remember that. "Oh, mom, that man was so nice. He wasn't mad at us." I'm sure that he didn't hear 3 words of the homily because they both had hearing aids in. And my kid, anyway, so you do, I just kind of feel like those are angels in the flesh, sort of people who welcome your children and help you to understand that this too shall pass as well.
It's also a good problem to have. It means that we have kids in the church. I feel like 20 years ago, we were not having these discussions about what it's like to have kids in mass. What does it mean? When I was in elementary school, we certainly weren't having these discussions. And I feel like now that we have more kids and more Catholics having kids, we do have this. There's no middle generation, I think. There's no continuation between the post-Vatican II Catholics, and there's this like sort of dead zone in my generation, the millennials, the children of the 80s and 90s. Like, I feel like there's this theological dead zone. And of all the kids that I went to Catholic school with, I think maybe one or two are still Catholic, myself not included there. But I think there's this dead zone. So you have older people and you have younger people, and we just kind of have to learn how to get along.
What about practical things? I mean, great gift somebody gave me once was like a magnetic mass thing where the kids can kind of like follow along. And the other day I was at a church that was very kid friendly and they had mass bingo cards. And I was like, oh, I gotta get these. But I don't know, do you have like little tools or practical tips for parents that are trying to like both keep them under control, but also, not just coloring Minnie Mouse pages or whatever, which I'm not judging parents who do that
I'm
either.
not judging if that's what it takes. We've done Magnificid. Our kids really like that. That's for a little bit older. But in addition, there's like tons of kids' books and kids' coloring books. And we have like a Father Gets Ready for Mass book where it's a coloring book where he puts on his vestments and his vestments are different colors. We've just gone to the regular old Christian bookstore and gotten themed books. But one thing that I think made a huge difference in my kids' life when it came to mass was getting a home mass kit. And these are not expensive. You can get them on Etsy. You can get them at the Catholic bookstore. The one we have came from Shining Light Dolls, but it's a little wooden mass kit, and the kids can say mass. And we've had mass. They go outside and they say mass for the chickens. They've used my coffee table to say mass for the dog. They've loved it, and it's a good opportunity to teach them the parts of the mass and what people do and what the Eucharist means and how the consecration works. They've had a great time, and I think they know more about the Eucharist than I did when I made my first communion at the time, and they're barely in first grade.
Well, I think there's a renewed interest in this also because of Pope Leo. I just reviewed the new Vatican documentary, Leo from Chicago, and his brother John did one of the interviews, and they said, he has Necco wafers, which are kind of an old school candy for those who don't know, and his mom's ironing board, and he said they played mass every day, and he said, no, my brother didn't think that was play. He thought that was real. And so he would go to daily mass with his mom early in the morning, and then they would have their play mass with the ironing board. And I mean, my brother did that when we were kids as well. And then that really fell out of fashion or whatever. But now I think Pope Leo's really drawn a lot of attention to kids doing that.
My kids are little kids from Chicago. And we've said, like, there's a kid from Chicago that is now the Pope. And you're a little kid from Chicago, and you can be the Pope. So I think there is a huge renewed sense of a Catechesis of the Good Shepherd does a lot of this, which is, fairly
It's very
recent.
Montessori, right? Like a
Yeah,
Montessori
it's
sort of learns
Montessori and
you
it's
experientially.
hands-on. Yeah. And I know my kids have had altars in their classrooms for the same reason at Catholic school. And I think there's just a renewed sense of wanting to bring your kids into the faith too. It means something to me. It means something to my husband, and we want it to mean something to our kids, not just be something that they do on Sundays. So having that mass kit is really, our chickens are very, very well attended when it comes to the mass
Well,
obligation.
we didn't have, there were no mass kits back then. You had to, like, again, go find the Necco wafers and a towel that your mom wasn't using and that sort of stuff. So
We
it's
have the
like,
Italian cruet, the oil and vinegar, and the salt and pepper.
that's so funny. Oh, that's really funny. I hadn't thought of that.
Yep. So we have the like the old grandma Italian stuff that we got that they use.
There's a time and a place for everything, right? And all these things, everything has, it comes back around, right? So, well, you know what? While we're wrapping up, just tell us a little bit about this meeting that the Holy Father, this digital meeting for teens that he's going to be having. And any thoughts that you have about that particular encounter with teens? Do you think that's going to be effective in the format they've laid out?
I'm so excited for them. I think if I'd had the opportunity to do this, my husband got lucky enough to go to World Youth Day with Pope John Paul II. I never had the opportunity to do these things, and it's so cool in this digital day and age that you can just up and Zoom the Pope.
Right. And the Pope doesn't have to come here. Yeah. I was just saying we just had the anniversary of when John Paul II came to Chicago, and that was the first city he came to because of the large Polish presence here. And so we got like 3 days off school. And I mean, even kids who weren't really practicing went to any of one of the things you could try to get into or get close to. It really electrified the faith of so many young people.
And you see so many kids. I am always blown away Katie McGrady is one of my friends, and I'm always blown away by the picture she sends of the youth conferences that she goes to and speaks at. And they're just packed to the gills. And then I go even over to our Catholic school, and they call it Alleluia Day, but it's a day that's just primarily focused on adoration. They have the Blessed Sacrament out all day, and they're singing hymns, and the kids just love it. My kids wait all year for Alleluia Day, and it's feels electric in a way that I didn't experience when I was a kid. And, I grew up as an Italian Catholic. It's part of my blood, but it's just a new way to experience the faith through my kids. And I hope that this becomes a massive thing for them, and they know that they can talk to the Holy Father in a way that he's always been so distant from us. And to say that he's going to be on a Zoom call is mind-boggling to me.
Well, this has been a great conversation, Emily. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I'm joined by our TCA resident chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry. Monsignor Landry, today is a great feast, and you are in the environs of St. Rose Philippine Duchenne. Let's talk about her legacy to the United States.
It's been a joy for me to be in St. Louis this week at the Augustine Institute, where there's been a retreat for all the diocesan directors of the Pontifical Mission Societies, led by Cardinal Sean O'Malley, the Archbishop Emeritus of Boston. And it gave me a chance on Monday to visit St. Rose Philippine Duchenne's tomb, which is in St. Charles, Missouri, a short drive away from Florissant, which is where I presently am and at the Augustine Institute. And then on Thursday night, I had the privilege to be able to give a talk on lessons we can all learn from St. Rose Philippine Duchenne about the mission. She's not all that well known outside of the St. Louis area. That's a unique thing in the church in the United States, that a lot of our saints, we just don't celebrate across the country, but only celebrate locally. But she was born in 1769 from a very well-off family in the southeast of France, in a place called Grenoble, at the entrance to the French Alps. And she had become a visitation nun. St. Francis de Sales and Saint Jean de Chantal had founded the Visitation Sisters. But during the French Revolution, her convent was closed. She had to live at home with a few of her relatives who were visitation nuns. After Napoleon signed a concordat with the Vatican to allow them to get back to religious life, she couldn't save the monastery. But eventually she turned it over to St. Madeleine Sophie Barat from the Society of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. She became a sister together with St. Madeleine Sophie, and the whole rest of her life continued. She kept that cloistered sense of the importance of prayer, but she was able, as an active sister now, to fulfill eventually one of her great goals, was to go to the missions and help others to learn how to pray. And so when she was 49 years old, in 1818, she sailed across the Atlantic all the way to New Orleans, and she came up the Mississippi River to St. Charles, Missouri, where she founded the first free school west of the Mississippi, and she started a whole career of training young girls in the art of education. Eventually, when she was 72 years old, after she was no longer capable of the full-time grind of being a teacher, she went out to Sugar Creek, Kansas, to the Potawatomi, and anybody who's listening who knows Archbishop Chaput, even by reputation, the great former Archbishop of Denver and of Philadelphia. He was from that part of Kansas and a Potawatomi by descendancy. She went out there to evangelize the Potawatomi. Even though she didn't know the language, she was able to teach them about the importance of prayer. And so she was famous for going into the teepee where there was the Blessed Sacrament and eventually a building, kneeling down all night. The young Indian girls would quietly come on in and put stuff on the back of her sweater to just see whether she would actually lie down in the middle of the night. And then they'd come in the morning and they'd look, and exactly where they had placed what they had put on her sweater was where it was. And so they made up a nickname for her, which I think is one of the most beautiful nicknames anybody could ever have. Kwakahadnumad, which means the woman who always prays. And after a time out there with the Potawatomi, she came back to St. Charles, Missouri, where she died in 1852. But for the whole rest of her life, she was Kwakahadnumad. She was the woman who was always praying, because mission work begins first and foremost with praying to the harvest master to send laborers for his harvest. And that's one of the reasons why St. Thérèse Lisieux, for example, is a co-patroness of the missions, because she supported them by her prayer. And St. Rose Philippine Duchenne, that great missionary teacher and catechist, was more than any other thing someone who teaches us how to pray for the missions. And so it was a great joy for me.
Well, as a person who had an aunt who was a Sacred Heart nun, I have a special affection for St. Rose Philippine as well. So this Sunday, we have a special feast coming up.
So the end of the church's liturgical year is always the solemnity of Christ, King of the universe, that all of the church's liturgical year is meant to prepare us for the end of time. In November, we particularly focus on the four last things. And what's going to happen is Christ's triumph will be known to everybody. That's why it's important every year. But this year, it's especially important, not just because it's happening during the Jubilee of Hope, but because it was made a feast during the Jubilee of 1925 by the great missionary Pope Pius XI. So this year, we're marking the 100th anniversary of the establishment of the Solemnity of Christ the King. And so we need to put a little bit of extra effort into this. He decreed this feast in 1925 after the work of the Bolshevik communists, after all the martyrdoms that were taking place in Mexico, trying to eliminate Christianity with this militant secularism. And Pope Pius XI wanted everybody to acknowledge and to strengthen Catholics, particularly in our knowledge, that Christ was indeed king. He was a king who allowed himself to be crucified in order to reign, but he will reign forever and ever, as Handel's great Alleluia reminds us. And so this Sunday is a great opportunity for us, celebrating 100th birthday of the feast, to say, is Christ really the king of my mind, the king of my heart, the king of my will? Is he the king of my pocketbook or wallet? Is he a king of my time? Is he a king of my affections? Is he the king of my family? Are we at least treating Christ as our king? Are we meaning the words, thy kingdom come? Are we seeking to follow him, or are we seeking to displace him from his authority? These are all big questions for us to have, because the way we're going to convert the whole world to Christ is when we're able to recouple those two prayers in the Our Father that Jesus taught us, one right after another. When we say, thy kingdom come, what we are essentially saying is, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Christ's kingdom, which is already among us, is entered into when people seek to do the Lord's will, not just because he said it, but do it with love because we trust him and we want to please him. And we really believe that he's showing us the path to true happiness. And so we celebrate all of these things this Sunday, but happy 100th anniversary, Betsy.
Thank you. And I will remind you, since this is a St. Louis-centric podcast today, that one of my favorite hymns, To Jesus Christ, Our Sovereign King, was written by Monsignor Hellriegel, who was here in St. Louis.
To Jesus Christ, our Sovereign King, who is the world's salvation, all praise and honor do we bring with glad adoration indeed. Happy Solemnity, Benson.
Thank you, Monsignor. Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. Today we have a really extraordinary guest, Dr. Tom Katina. Dr. Tom is an American physician who serves as medical director and surgeon at Gedel Mother of Mercy Hospital in the Nuba Mountains of Sudan since 2008, when that hospital opened. He's affectionately known there as Dr. Tom. He's received an extraordinary number of awards, including the Time 100 in 2015. In 2017, he was awarded the second annual Aurora Prize for Awakening Humanity. And in 2024, he was awarded the Theodore Roosevelt Award, the highest honor the National Collegiate Athletic Association, the NCAA, may confer on an individual. And he's also been awarded honorary doctorates from Brown University and Duke University, where he received his medical degree. Welcome to the show, Dr. Tom.
Thanks, Betsy. Good to be here.
I know that you're headed momentarily back to the Sudan, so we're thrilled that you're here. Let's talk about how an Italian American got from an all-American nose guard at Brown to being the only surgeon for an area encompassing 1 million people. I know you've told this story a lot, but we're kind of interested in your Catholic faith angle here, about what your childhood was like as a Catholic kid growing up in an Italian-American household.
Right. So I had a pretty standard, I'd say, upbringing. Six siblings, big Italian-American family. My dad was a daily communicant. My mom was always a devout Catholic. I think I told you before that my mother had kind of a weird detour into I guess more or less the occult. There was a guy named Edgar Cayce's back in the I think it was back in the 70s and 80s. You know, it's funny because she went to mass with us every Sunday, and she maintained her Catholicism, but she kind of veered off into the occult. And thanks be to God, she came back to the faith kind of through evangelical Protestants. And I think, if I remember correctly, she came back to the Catholic faith through Mother Angelica on EWTN. She was always watching her show, and then she got back into the Catholic Church and became a very, very staunch Catholic. I think that foray into the occult really scared her and kind of scared her back into the faith, and she became a much more fervent Catholic after that. Growing up, big family. I was an altar boy, standard. Going to church every weekend. But the public high schools didn't benefit from a Catholic education.
Well, it's kind of interesting because you sort of had a reawakening through a non-Catholic organization, Campus Crusade for Christ, in college.
Yeah, well, I was in college. I was kind of like my mom. I was going to church every Sunday and maintained the Catholic faith, and then got involved with the more of a Protestant organization, Campus Crusade for Christ. I mean, they would say they're ecumenical, but that often implies different branches of the Protestant religion come together. It's not so much geared towards Catholics. Anyway, they welcomed me with open arms, and it was there where I saw the faith lived out. I saw people there taking the faith very seriously, that this was had to become part and parcel of your life. Christianity was a lived religion. It wasn't something you did your Sunday obligation for, now 45 minutes or half an hour sometimes, then you're done for the week. That's not all there is. That's a tiny, tiny portion of what living your religion is. And I really credit that campus minister, Kent Dahlberg, and my friends there with kind of bringing me back into the fold of Christianity in general, and then pointing me back to the Catholic faith as I delved more deeply into things.
You also had an uncle growing up who was a doctor that maybe at the time you didn't think, oh, I want to be like him. But looking back, can you tell us about Uncle Fiore and how he impacted your life?
Right, Uncle. So Fiore Pippito was the general practitioner in my hometown, and he was an old style doc. When he first came up, an Italian immigrant, came from Sicily, went to did his medical studies in the U.S., was an army doctor during World War II, came out and set up practice in my hometown in the late 40s, 50s, and he was there for 50 years as the hometown doc. And he did everything initially, took care of kids, old people. He did surgery. And when I saw that, I thought that's what doctors did. And although in my formative years, I didn't want to be a doctor, in the back of my mind, I thought that's, if I ever do this or whatever kind of work I want to do, I like that idea. You're a generalist. You kind of do bits of everything, and you integrate yourself in the community. You're the person that people come to when they have problems. You're kind of the go-to person for that area. That idea of the small town doc, I found very appealing.
So your world takes a kind of crazy turn because you go to Brown and you get a degree in engineering and you think you're going to work on a nuclear submarine for GE, but you decide not to do it. What happened?
Well, I would say this Campus Crusade crowd got me going on the idea of doing mission work. I never thought that was even a possibility. My foray into medicine was through this idea of being a missionary. And, in high school and my first year or two of college, I thought, let me just get my degree and get out, start making money, get a nice house in the suburbs, couple cars, live the American dream. But it didn't quite sit well with me. I just kept hearing this call of doing mission work, but nothing was really making sense initially. Then after I graduated, the idea just came to my head to do mission work, that I should go into medicine. It was actually on the way back from my Aunt Fanny's funeral. Fanny was my actually the sister of Uncle Fiore, and we were coming back from her funeral in Albany, New York, and I was coming back with my brother Felix, and the idea just popped in my head. Now we would say it was the prompting of the Holy Spirit, but I turned to my brother Felix. I said, "Hey, I think I should go into medicine." He said, "I think you're crazy. You're an engineer, you got a job, blah, blah." So I said, "No, I think this is what I should do." And things kind of made a bit of sense to me finally, that angst that I had for a while now, I felt kind of lifting. And it was a bit of a challenge, and I had to go through a lot of hoops, but things worked out.
So you ended up in Japan, then you ended up in the Navy, and then you go to medical school, and right out of medical school, do you decide, I'm going to Africa?
Well, the way things work, I think they're still the same, is when you apply to medical school, you have to take the MCATs first, the Medical College Admission Test. And I had to do a year of pre-med requirements. I hadn't done all those in undergrad, and the MCAT then would be in that spring. So if you do it in the spring, you can't apply for the following fall. So I had to do that in the spring and then take another year, had kind of a gap year. And I was trying to decide what to do, and I went back to Brown and just went to their jobs office, and I came across a flyer. This was back in the days when you had, books with binders and everything else. Nothing was
Right.
on. The internet was not there then. I came across this flyer for this program teaching English to Japanese in Japan. I thought, man, that sounds pretty cool. I had always had an interest in the Orient, and I thought this would be a great adventure for a year. So I ended up going to Japan for a year, taught English, had a wonderful experience. It was a great time of deepening of my Catholic faith. There was a Franciscan chapel in a place called Roppongi, which is in Tokyo. It was kind of a place with a lot of nightclubs, a lot of nightlife, and in the middle of all that was a Franciscan church with a great couple of great old Franciscan priests. I went there, and that kind of started my interest in Franciscan spirituality. And my thinking then was, if I go to medical school, I'll be saddled with a huge debt when I finish, and that'll dictate what I can do. I thought, well, if I want to do mission work and I have a huge debt, I won't be able to do it because I'll have to work and get a bunch of money to pay the debt off. So my reasoning was, let me take a Navy scholarship. That's a set number of years. I'll go and do my time in the Navy, and then I'll be free to do what I want. So that's kind of how it worked out.
So, did you learn surgery in the Navy? Because I know that you eventually became a surgeon, but that maybe really wasn't your main focus in your residency.
Right. So my time in the Navy, I did my internship at Naval Hospital of San Diego, and that was in internal medicine. I thought I wanted to do. I figured, well, if I go in the mission field, especially in Africa, they have a lot of infectious diseases, malaria and tuberculosis and parasitic diseases. I thought, let me do internal medicine and then specialize in infectious disease. That was my thinking going in. So I did my year of internal medicine in San Diego, and I mean, I didn't really like it that much. I thought this, was kind of not that interesting. And then I had time off. In the Navy, you do an internship, then you go out and what they say, you go to the fleet and you work as a medical officer, a very junior doctor with just an internship, and you take care of the sailors, or the airmen, or whatever unit you end up with. So I wanted to do what's called flight surgery. Finished my internship, and then I went to the flight surgeon training course, Pensacola, Florida, and then I became a flight surgeon. I did that for 4 years. And flight surgery is a bit of a misnomer. We're not doing surgery at Mach 1. It's you're basically a doctor for a squadron of pilots and the air crew, and you take care of the very minor complaints. It's taking care of pus. What I say is taking care of pilots with colds, and it's not doing any surgery at all. So I didn't have any surgical training in the Navy. I did very basic stuff. Then I got out of the Navy, and it was time for residency, and I figured, okay, let me do family practice because I wanted a broad training. I kind of liked a bit of everything. I thought, well, if I go in the mission field, I'll need some broad training, and that's why I ended up doing family practice.
So you would do eventually get to Africa, but not Sudan.
Well, I was finally time to make a decision. And it's 19 December 1999, and I thought, okay, it's time to make a decision. I finished all my obligations. I have no debt, and this is 14, 15 years after I had that kind of revelation with my brother in the car that I should do medicine and that I should go and do missionary work. So I thought, okay, let me go and try it out. I kind of dipped my toe in the water and got in touch with the Catholic Medical Mission Board, and they sent me a list of hospitals, mostly in Africa, that were looking for a family practice doctor. And I just picked one. I thought, let me pick this one place. I'll go there for 1 year, do my thing, and then get it out of my system and come back to the U.S. and start working as a doctor. My idea of mission work was not you go there and you stay. It was you go, you sprinkle some drugs on people, and you come back. And you go back maybe after 10 years and do a bit and come back. That was kind of more of my idea. It wasn't more of a permanent, it wasn't something you did as a career. You didn't go, you didn't stay, you didn't kind of really work with the people. You didn't involve yourself fully. It was kind of more of a very brief kind of part-time thing. Anyway, so I get to Kenya, and my idea in my brain is I'm going to go and do 1 year. And then I met my first hospital I worked at was called Mutombo Hospital, which was in a very poor area of Kenya, a very remote, rural place. And it was run by Irish Mercy Sisters. They'd established this hospital, I think, back in the, I forget when it was, maybe back in the 60s. And they were still there, and they were training a bunch of Kenyan Mercy Sisters on how to run the hospital. And I met Sister Bridget, who was one of the first people I met. She's an Irish nun who was the matron, the head nurse. And she was so excited. She said, "Great, Tom, I hear that you're coming to work with us for 2 years. That's really wonderful." And I'm thinking, hey, I thought I'm here for 1 year. I didn't sign up for 2 years. So anyway, I didn't want to disappoint Sister Bridget. So I said, okay, I'll stay for 2 years. And that became 2.5. And then I said, well, I really need to learn how to do some surgery. I'm not trained as a surgeon. I didn't officially train as a surgeon, let me put it that way. I thought I really need to learn how to do more surgery. And I started looking for ways to do that in Kenya.
So, how do you get to Sudan?
Funny how the Lord works. So I was in Mutomo and think, okay, I need to learn how to do more surgery. I was already kind of set to go to Nairobi in Kenya. There's a long story. There was a Marian priest, an American, who had a hospital in Nairobi, big mission hospital. I knew him from many years before. He said, "Why don't you come to Nairobi and work with us here?" I told him, I said, "Look, I want to learn some surgery." He said, "Fine, I'll give you a couple days a week, or a day a week in the operating room, and you can learn all you want. We have a lot of surgery." So before going there, I met an American Franciscan priest, Kevin Flanagan, who was up in the northern part of Kenya in a place called Turkana, way up in the desert. So I was going to go there for a few months before starting in Nairobi. So I got up to Turkana in the north of Kenya, and Kevin was there. He was teaching me surgery. I'm doing things. And then after a few weeks, he said, I've got to go back to the US to do my surgical boards. He says, somebody's coming to cover for me when I'm out. And it was the person coming to cover was Dee Dee Byrne, who was now Sister Dee Dee Byrne. And at the time, she was just Dee Dee. And I was talking to her about Sudan. And I kept hearing about Sudan, that it was such a challenge. I said, I'd like to go there and work someday. And she said, hey, I know a bishop who was building a hospital there. So Dee Dee connected me to Bishop Makram Gassis, who by chance had a office in Nairobi. He was living there in exile from Sudan. So I went to Nairobi. I was supposed to go there anyway. Started working at this mission hospital in Nairobi. And I was going to his office. I would start going there, and they said, yeah, we're just starting to build a hospital. It's going to take, some years. Why don't you keep in touch with us? So I would go there for a while, I went there every couple of weeks. I would meet with the program director. We'd talk about the hospital. We'd make plans. And this ended up taking about 6 years. So I first went to Nairobi in 2002 and didn't start in Nuba until 2008. So that went through lots of ups and downs. I mean, getting anything done in Sudan takes forever. And this, of course, was no exception. So I thought during that time, are these guys ever going to get this done? I started looking elsewhere to go. Should I go to Congo? I wasn't that interested in staying in Nairobi long term. It was great. My time in Nairobi was really necessary. I learned pretty much all the surgery I do now. I learned there in Nairobi from
I
excellent
see.
teachers.
Yeah.
There's an American surgeon named Mike Johnson. Mike was a missionary surgeon, and Mike taught me a ton of surgery. There's a Rucha, Dr. Rucha, who was a Kenyan surgeon, taught me a lot. Other sur visiting surgeons would come and teach things. So I was in Kenya a total of about 7 years, 5 years in Nairobi. And I did enough. I think I did enough surgery there. Total, I probably did 2,500 cases easily in Nairobi. So I did enough. I did enough to the point where I felt competent that I could go somewhere on my own and operate.
The reason I asked about the surgery is because the amazing documentary, The Heart of Nuba, shows you in the operating room a lot. And because Sudan has been at war most of its existence, that's a big part of what you have to do is deal with people who have been hit by shrapnel and all kinds of things. So their government subjects the people to starvation, sickness, and war. How do you keep your wits and your strength about you when you know that this is a country that's waging war on its own people.
My take on it is a lot of things we have no control over. It's a lot of things are political. Political environment in Sudan is terrible. It's a total mess. I have no control over that. But there are people there, and people are suffering. And one thing I can do is try to take care of them to the best of my ability, and garner resources and bring other people in to take care of them. So I see that as one way I can contribute and try to alleviate at least some of the suffering of the people there.
Talk to us about a typical day that you have at the hospital.
Well, t days are extremely busy. I'll take you say, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday are pretty much the same. So I get up around 5:30 in the morning. I don't have an alarm clock. I haven't used one. I don't know how long, 25 years. And I just get up, and then first light, I'm up. I get my wife and young baby up. He's about a year and a half. We have a little bit of something to eat. I'll go down to the hospital, try to get there by a little before 7. We have a chapel right in the hospital grounds. We have a kind of our hospital shaped like a U, and kind of in that middle courtyard. We have a small chapel. I try to get there by 7 and say some morning prayers. I try to say my rosary to just try to get the day going, put my brain in the right mood for facing the challenges that I know will come that day. 7:30, we have a hospital chaplain that says mass every day from 7:30 to 8. So other staff come, some patients come. We have morning mass from 7:30 to 8. 8 o'clock, we start the work in the wards, and I'll do the ward rounds. I'll start with the staff. We have PAs. Now we have three Nuba doctors that we're training, nurses, midwives. Start the rounds on the maternity ward. For the next 5 hours, I'll be doing ward rounds. Maternity ward, go to the female ward, go to the male ward, go to the children's ward, go to the ICU slash high dependency unit. And I mean, in the all the while seeing patients coming from the TB and leprosy ward. Then we finish ward rounds. That's about up to about 1:30. Well, at that time, I go to the minor operating room and we'll knock out all the minor cases that we've accumulated during the morning. So women having miscarriages, we take care of abscess, needs to be drained, bones need to be set. That's done then. And from there, look at X-rays or X-ray units right there. Look at the X-rays that we've picked up during the morning. And then usually wrap up and go to the clinic. And I get to the clinic 1:32, maybe 2 o'clock. And then I'll see 50 patients in clinic. That'll take the rest of the afternoon. Finish up around 6:30 and then go and do my correspondence, emails, kind of administrative duties. And kind of limp home and have time with the family. We eat together and put the kids to bed. And then, I take calls at night. Of course, I'm on call. Any emergencies that come at night, any surgical emergency, any obstetrical emergency, I've got to be prepared to take. So that's what I do at night. I've got some help. I've got the PAs do the primary call, and they'll do that. There's always somebody else on call, so I'm kind of a backup person on call.
That's a long day. That's a long week. The PA you talked about, you're trying to create a legacy that outlasts you. So can you talk about the St. Bikita Health Training Institute? It's such an interesting story that you're now trying to get native local people to eventually run the show.
Right. So since we started back in 2008, we've been of the mind that we have to train the people there. It's part of what all mission hospitals do. I mean, I think it's like 40%, 30, 40% of healthcare in East Africa is by mission hospitals. And mission hospitals traditionally come into a place, they set things up. In the old days, the Catholic mission hospitals would come with a whole team of sisters, and brothers, and they would have a whole cadre of health personnel. They set the place up, they start training. They train nurses, they would send people out for medical training. Before you know it, you get a full complement of locally trained staff. So we were kind of trying to follow that model from the beginning. So initially, we're setting people out. We started with 15 local staff. The one with the highest education level had finished 8th grade. So there was not a single trained nurse, let alone doctor or midwife in the Blue Mountains, not one. That person with the highest education level was 8th grade, as I said. There were no high school graduates, let alone there were no nurses. There were no high school graduates when we first got there. So the year after we started getting high school graduates coming back. These guys had been in school, refugee camps in Kenya. We hired them at the hospital. We gave them some on-the-job training. We started sending them out right away. We sent them to Kenya. We sent them to South Sudan, to Uganda, Tanzania, wherever. Wherever we could find a spot, we sent people out for training. Nurses, midwives, PAs, medical doctors, lab technicians, whatever you need to run a hospital. We said, let's get these people out, get them trained, let them come back. And we did this for several, we sent maybe 90 people out. And then, about 4 years ago, for many years, we said we need to have our own training school. So we can train our own people, try to instill the values that we have, that we think are important as a Catholic Health Training Institute. So I found about 4 years ago, we finally amassed a critical mass of people that could help us to do this, and we started the St. Bikita Health Training Institute. The first class was clinical officers, PAs, and we just graduated our first cohort of 19. They graduated this June, or June of 25, and they're now currently doing their internship with us, and that's been a huge boost. They're really good. They're well trained. They're very smart. We also have 29 midwives who are currently in training, and they'll all graduate this coming June, June of 26. They'll all graduate. And that's going to, I think, quadruple the number of midwives in the Blue Mountains. Want to get those people out.
And is that one of the primary concerns, is just maternal care and infant care? I mean, is if you solve some of those issues, then does that help just the overall situation where you're not dealing with fistulas and all the things that I've heard you talk about?
Sure, that's part of it. So, what we try to do is take a very comprehensive approach to medical care. So, maternal child health is part of what we do. But we also try to incorporate vaccines, antenatal clinic, so see mothers before they deliver birth. We have vaccination program. We're the surgical hospital for the entire region. We have an eye clinic. We have a guy, a PA, trained in eye surgery. He's the eye surgeon for all of Nuba Mountains. For 3 million plus people, he's the only guy they can go to. We're putting up a physical therapy unit now. We have a PA slash a psychiatrist. He's a physician assistant. He went through an extra school, a 2 year course in psychiatry. So we're trying to be as comprehensive as we can, covering all the different areas of medicine. So a big part of that, obviously, is maternal child health. They're usually a biggest risk for problems. They're the most neglected often. Sudan, South Sudan, and the Nuba Mountains is similar to them, in that we have probably the high. We have the South Sudan has the highest maternal mortality rate in the world, and there was not a great study, but a bit of a study done on Nuba Mountains, and our rate is similar or higher than South Sudan in terms of maternal mortality. This is a woman who dies in either in child, who dies from a pregnancy related condition, so who dies before giving birth, during birth, or in the immediate period after birth from something related to that pregnancy. So it can be the most common cause is bleeding. They give birth to the baby, they just bleed to death, and there are no trained health personnel to help her. So all these efforts to train midwives. We also have 19 peripheral clinics that we run. We want to upgrade those clinics to be what's called a BEMOC, which is a basic emergency obstetric and neonatal care center. So those clinics, we want to have a midwife there. We want to equip that midwife with the medications and equipment she needs to do a safe delivery, and to identify those who might have a very risky delivery, get them referred up to the hospital so we can take care of them.
So I want to talk just as we close out about the Sudanese people. You fell in love with one and you now have two children. And there's a quote that you have that says the feeling that joy is the feeling that you are where you are supposed to be. And you clearly exude that, but talk a little bit about the resilience of the Sudanese and the joy of the people, because watching the documentaries about you, it's hard to see people running into foxholes because there are bombers trying to bomb your hospital. How do they have this just innate joy that was so attractive to you that made you want to stay there forever?
Well, I think people that have been subject to hardship their entire lives, in a sense, they kind of get, I don't want to say immune, but it becomes part of who they are. They put up with more tragedies and hardships than we can even imagine. I mean, my wife, for instance, when she grew up in the 80s and 90s, she had friends, childhood friends of hers die of starvation. I mean, how many people can say that? I mean, it's unbelievable what she's been through. She had to witness public executions of people that were accused of collaborating with the enemy. Her primary school was under a tree. I mean, very, very kind of erratic, sporadic education. So my wife, as an example of kind of a typical Nuba person, had a very difficult upbringing, was exposed to a lot of hardships. So consequently, they can put up with a lot of nonsense and difficulties. They're difficult to put down. They'll bounce back up, and they'll just keep pushing ahead. I mean, I don't want to mythologize the people there. They have their own issues and their own problems, but they can tolerate things that would break all of us.
Well, I know that you've had people that had missiles stuck in their shoulders and you just pulled them out. They had a hole in them and they just kept on going. So, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real joy to listen to your stories and to listen to your faith journey. How can people learn more about you, Dr. Tom?
Well, we have a few partners. Our main partners are African Mission Healthcare, and they, if you want to help us financially or just learn more about us, you can go to the website. I think it's africanmissionhealthcare.com. There's a direct site for donations, which is healthfornuba.org. www.sudanreliefund.com. We're also supported by the Sudan Relief Fund, which also has a website. So those are our two main partners financially. Catholic Medical Mission Board is also another partner that helps with some of our programs. So if anybody feels obligated or feels the need to donate to our cause, you can check out one of those organizations and just specify you want to do it for Mother of Mercy Hospital, which is our hospital in Sudan.
Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck on your journey back to Sudan.
Okay, thanks, Betsy.